Today, we're going to be looking at a little bit of the history of resilience. Because, as I was saying, it's a word that we bounce around as if everybody knows what it means and everyone agrees on what it means, and as if it's been used in this way forever. But in fact, it's only really in the past 60 years that resilience, in the sense of a person having resilience in order to cope and thrive beyond challenges, has been used as a thing. So let's just step back a minute and see where that came from. First of all, I will give you a definition. It's hard to find a definition. You go to the psychology pages and they all say, well, resilience is a bit of this and it's a bit of that. But this is one I like. Resilience can be viewed as a defense mechanism which enables people to thrive in the face of adversity. You want me to repeat that? I see the pencils going. Resilience can be viewed as a defense mechanism which enables people to thrive in the face of adversity. Another way it's described. Oh, you're looking confused at me, Sean?
That sounds so dismal. I think of resilience as such a good, positive thing, and that sounds very like, oh, this is what you gotta do.
Well, no, it enables you to thrive.
Okay,
It's
that's the
a
word.
defense against succumbing to the challenges. Another way that it's put often is it's the ability to bounce back more quickly and often stronger than before.
There is a phrase that I heard for the first time a few years back, and I was listening because of what's happened in my life. It's kind of in opposition to PTSD. The phrase is post-traumatic strength.
Yes, that's good. Post-traumatic strength. Nice. And also during traumatic strength. Hopefully, with each challenge, you come out stronger so that the next challenge is less traumatic. In fact, one of the guys I'm going to mention has redefined, or not, has renamed the term trauma to be a potentially traumatic experience, a PTE, because it needn't be traumatic. But let's get back to the beginning. Resilience actually has its roots as far back as Freud, who I discovered lived until 1939. I didn't realize he'd lived that late into the last century, but as you probably know, his thing was that adult issues arise from childhood trauma, as a sort of brass tacks thing that he did. And he was accepted and all. There's nothing wrong with that, but he was mostly based or entirely based on his own observations. In the 40s, there was a Freudian psychologist named John Bowlby, who was interested in applying this newfangled thing called the scientific approach to Freud's model. So he wanted to come up with a scientific theory with evidence to support, but also to show, to learn more about how trauma results in adult challenges. So he was the first one to start researching with serious research the work or the model that Freud came up with. And he worked with largely with orphaned and evacuated kids during World War II. And what he was looking for is if childhood experiences cause difficulties in adulthood. He wanted to find out if there were certain risk factors in childhood. Of course, a trauma is the obvious one, but it isn't necessarily a single trauma that can cause an issue. It can be a way of being brought up, or a situation, or, you know, that you live in for a long period of time. So he was looking for what these risk factors are that cause adults. Can't think of a good word. Issues is not really the best word, but you know, problems with either mental, emotional challenges, inability to keep a job or to integrate into society well, that sort of thing. So he was looking for what these risk factors were, and he did identify a bunch of things. But his work with the orphans and led to him continuing in that direction, and he's the one who eventually came up with attachment theory, and saw the consequences, long-term consequences, of the loss of a mother figure in a child, which of course is what was happening with these orphan kids. Their families would be bombed and they'd survive and they'd lose their parents. And so attachment theory is still around, and you know, kids need to have a mother figure to be healthy, or more ideally ought to, I guess is the way of putting it. So that was like the 40s. And then in the 60s, a guy called Norman Garmazy was also looking at these risk factors. That was the direction that child psychology was going. But he found that when he worked with a group of kids that all had the same risk factors, that should be growing up with some sort of challenge as an adult, emotional, mental, social, there was always a small percentage that just came out fine, despite the risk factors. There's something about a percentage, and it was pretty consistent, that he worked with groups of kids, you know, not just one. He did this numerous times in his research, and there was always this small group that was okay. So he started looking at them and was able to identify a characteristic that they all seemed to share. He couldn't identify, you know, the real details of it yet, but it seemed to be a characteristic, and he called that resilience. So that's the first time that word was used in the context of a personality being able to overcome challenges and come out stronger, and to bounce back and come out stronger. So he thought, let's figure out what resilience is. And he stopped looking at risk factors and started looking for protective factors. So instead of trying to avoid things in childhood that are going to be a problem, let's see if we can instill things that are going to mitigate any risk factors that might already be there. Does that make sense? So that was Garmazy, and he was sort of the first one to start looking for protective factors. Now, right around the same time, starting in 1955, a psychologist named Emily Warner did a longitudinal study for 32 years. She did a study. She studied 698 children, which was the entire birth population of 1955 on the island of Kauai. Now, I don't know why she chose that, but that was perfect, because they're going to pretty much be in the same environment. And she could study them, and she studied them for 32 years. She published her paper in 1989. And so she was able, with this huge amount of data, to start identifying some of the protective factors that Garmazy had started working on. And she found two common things that seemed to be very universal amongst the kids who displayed this resilience thing. One was that they had a strong adult connection with a non-parent. So remember, these kids are not all orphans, like Bowlby was working with. These kids would have had a variety of having parents and not having parents or whatever, but they all had a strong connection with someone else who wasn't a parent, like a teacher or a pastor or something like that. And the second thing that these successful, which is a word I don't like, but that's how they're calling them, successful kids had, was what she called an internal locus of control. Not locust, like that eats your crops, but locust. And the internal locus of control is a sense that I have some ability to affect what's going on. So if you don't have an internal locus of control, it's the universe is dropping this tragedy on me. There's nothing I can do about it, and I just have to suffer. If you have an internal locus of control, it's more like, gosh, I wonder what I can do to make this better. Let me try this. Let me try that. So there's a sense of self-efficacy, like maybe I can't fix it, but I can do something, and I'm going to try. So those are two things that Emily Warner identified amongst lots and lots of other stuff in her 32-year study. So she published in the late 80s. In the late 60s, so just sort of paralleling her study, there's a guy called Martin Seligman, and he was doing some research on child psychology and made an accidental discovery. Where he discovered, I think he was actually working with rats at this time, but what he discovered is that helplessness can be learned. So he found that even that you can learn to be in efficacious. You can learn to think that you're helpless, even when you have the ability to change something. You don't try to do it because you believe that there's nothing you can do. So he called this learned helplessness. You might have heard of this phrase. And then you put that together with Emily Warner's discoveries, and the conclusion was, well, maybe if you can learn to be helpless, maybe you can also learn not to be helpless. Maybe you can learn to have an internal locus of control. Maybe you can learn to be resilient instead of just being born with it. So that was good news. And that, Martin Seligman went on to use to establish and launch positive psychology, which you can see is instead of the psychology of what can go wrong, he was looking at what can go right and how can we intentionally make things go right in child development specifically. But I think it's sort of spread to anybody these days. Now that was late 60s. Emmy Warner finished in the late 80s. Resilience studies is now a contemporary field, and one of the biggest names in it right at the moment is a guy called George Bonomo, not banana, but Bonomo, who is currently researching at Columbia, and he's adding into the mix the need for a positive framing. And this is what I was talking about before, the potential traumatic experience. As some people, if you look at it as a traumatic experience, it's going to be traumatic and it's going to have traumatic effects. It's going to have negative effects for you in the future. But if you are able to frame an event as a challenge, you know, it's not pleasant, you don't like it, but, you know, I'm going to try and learn from this. I'm going to try and approach it as something to be solved. Then this approach is has a more positive outcome, and is one of the characteristics of resilience, the ability to do that. And that's why he calls it a potential traumatic experience, because it's the sort of thing that if you're inclined to think of it as trauma, it'll be traumatic. But if you've trained yourself to frame it as a challenge, it needn't be traumatic. And so the bottom line of all of this that we've been talking about is that the positive traits and skills that make a person resilient are trainable. You can learn them, and they're actually more powerful, more important than your history or your risk factors. They will overcome risk factors that you have. So rather than trying to mitigate it's, of course, you want to bring children up in the most healthy way, but if you had trauma in your past, that does not condemn you to continually being traumatized and re-traumatized or not being able to grow more resilient. These skills are absolutely trainable. So that's what we're going to be looking at in the next few months, is what some of these skills are and how can we learn them. We're probably going to go a little bit over on the talk, if that's all right, but I'd like to open it up for your thoughts about what might be, or what have you done in the past that has helped you through challenges? What might be some of the skills or characteristics that are helpful in challenging situations? And you can either unmute and speak, or you can put something in chat if you want to. Obviously, you've all survived life until now. What were the things that you found that helped you to survive?
Well, certainly mindfulness.
Okay.
You know, just reminding myself that be present in the moment and what is actually going on at this exact second, at this exact moment, as opposed to sometimes what I think.
Right. Like the future is going to happen.
Oh, I'm good at writing stories about the future. I've written many lifetimes about myself. Uh-huh. That hopefully never happen.
Will have any of them yet?
I'm sure some have, but you know.
The good ones, I hope.
I wish I could tell you I write the good ones. I'm not very good about that. I would like to, that's what I need to do. I'm going to write a book about positive life.
Maybe that's the reframing bit.
Oh, I should get. It's amusing because I have spent the last 3 weeks dealing with female graduate students who have nothing positive to say about themselves.
Oh dear. Yep.
Yeah. So yeah. There's a theme here. Yep. I'll work on that.
I was going to say the same thing as trying to be in the present, because my mind just takes off and right. I go into fear, incredible fear. And I do gratitudes, just lots of gratitudes of what I have now and what is working now in my life. And once I get into those gratitudes, I realize that I have a pretty good life. If I can step away from the fear and just see what, and be in the moment. And life is good right now.
Yeah. Yeah, we have this negativity bias that we've evolved to have to keep us alive. But we don't really need quite so strongly now, in which you remember the negative much better than you remember the positive, because it's negative that's going to kill you. So you got to remember to stay away from it. But that's not the case anymore. So there's as much positive as there is negative. You just don't remember it unless you do, like you say, intentionally remind yourself of it.
There's a certain amount of space that I think you fare, or I fare much better with, as far as feeling that I have options. If I'm not sleeping enough, if I get pushed to a point with multiple traumas happening, there's not as much space for me to have a sense of my own ability to deal with things as a challenge.
Right. Yeah, there's like a tipping point where, okay, that's more than I can deal with right now.
So, and I'm using the word space because that's what it feels like.
Right. So maybe if the space gets too small, then the ability to deal gets shrunk also.
It's like a mental, emotional, psychological spaciousness.
Right. Yeah, I like that. Maybe we can learn to intentionally enlarge space around us. Be good. Well, these are definitely some of the things that we're going to be talking about. There are sort of three categories that I'm putting things into at this point that, based on all of this that I've been saying and what positive protective factors and learnable skills and all of this seem to divide up to me into sort of three categories. One is positivity, and something like gratitude would fall into that. There'd be emotions, of course, the positive framing that we just talked about. Also the ability to regulate your emotions. Maybe that doesn't necessarily sound like positivity, but not giving in and lashing out when you're angry, or not being overwhelmed with your strong emotions, but being able to manage your emotions. I'm throwing that into positivity. A second category is, I've actually given it this name, this is not from the psychology texts, but a self-determined lifestyle and self-determined action. And that would include the internal locus of control, having the ability to determine what you're going to do, living by your values, turns out to be very important, having some meaning in your life, some reason or some sense of purpose, you know, whatever, some reason to get up in the morning. I'm putting into the self-determined action and lifestyle. And then the final thing is connection. So that was that having a non-parent adult connection for children was very important. I don't know what your childhood was like, but the connection I had with my parents was very different from the connection I had from other people. Not that it was good or bad, but to have a more personal, gosh, I just thought of this, but like a self-determined connection, someone that you've chosen to be connected with. Socially, having some sort of social connection is important. You can put gratitude in here also because you're connecting with what's positive. So those three things, positivity, self-determination or self-efficacy, and connection, are the sort of categories into which these skills fall. We're going to be looking at elements from all of those, and possibly, quite possibly, other ones I haven't mentioned yet, because I'm learning also as we go. But that is the sort of direction we're going to be taking. And some weeks we will be working specifically with some meditation techniques to develop skills, and other weeks we'll be doing other activities and seeing if we can sort of mesh them together and come up with a framework that we can use to continue to grow our resilience. So that is your introduction. Any questions or comments about that? I'm not so far over time as I expected to be. No?
Can you spell Bowlby for me?
I think so. Bowlby.
Okay. And was it Emily Warner?
Emmy. Emma? I think I kept saying Emily, but it's Emmy, E-M-M-Y.
Okay, thank you.
And Martin Seligman.
Okay. And Norman Garmazi?
Norman, where'd he go? Garmazy.
Okay. Thank you.
And then Bonono is the guy that everyone seems to look at, you know, in the present time. What's George Bonono talking about? So there you have it, that resilience is a thing that we can learn. And it doesn't matter what your past has been like. It doesn't matter how you feel right now. We can still learn these and become more and more resilient. So that's what we're going to do.